The Bible is not all sweetness and light. There are a number of sections of angry passion, bitterness, and even of vindictiveness. All these sections have at least the virtue of emotional honesty. Evil exists. Men have spent their lives beaten, persecuted by other men. Despite the nice little pieties of some moralists, no one can spend his life in suffering without feeling anger, hate, without seeking revenge, word, if not in deed. Now, the 137th Psalm was written shortly after Nebuchadnezzar, emperor of Babylon, conquered Judea, wantonly razed the city of Jerusalem and the sacred temple, manacled and shackled almost the entirety of the Judean population, and led them off to slave labor camps. It's the first song of exile, the first Zionist song. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst thereof we hung up our harps. For there they did let us captive, asked of us words of song, and our tormentors required of us mirth, saying, sing to us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I remember thee not, if I set not Jerusalem above my chiefest joy. In these words, one can hear the tears and the pain, and one can get a glimpse of how this pain was caused, perpetrated, the back room in Babylonian police stations where the cruel Gauleiters said to these exiled people, now sing, dance for us, laugh, tell us gay stories, make us realize that nothing has happened. One hears also the curse that boiled up on their lips, the anger that blazed in their eyes, even if they could not express it with their fists. Remember, O Lord, against the children of Edom the day of Jerusalem, when they said, raise it, even to the foundations thereof. O daughter of Babylon, thou art to be destroyed. Happy shall he be that repayeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the rock. Now those who sit in their security, who write moralisms in their studies, are apt to look on these verses with disdain. Where is the patience, the forbearance, the acceptance, the turning of the other cheek? But how does man turn a cheek to sadism? And why should he? Such men are evil. Passivity, I'm afraid, only whets their bloodthirst. But Babel Hashdodeda, daughter of Babylon that art to be destroyed. Ashrei sheyishalem lach gemulech shegamalta lanu. Happy will be he who repays thee as thou hast served us. Now, ancient Babylon is modern Iraq. They are the same land, and fortunately the same bloodthirsty people. The lynching of 14 innocent men 2 weeks ago is only the latest evidence in a long and sad chronicle of cruelty and bestiality. This judicial murder, which was televised in prime time, saw tens of thousands of Iraqis dancing out their hate, their frenzy, around the bodies that were hung from the gibbets for days in the public square. And all the while, Radio Baghdad was announcing over and over again, I quote, "Come and enjoy the festival." But Babel Hashtodeda, Ashrei Sheyishalem Lach Gemulech Shegamalta Lanu, the daughter of Babylon who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be who repayeth thee as thou hast served us. The 14 who were killed were not guilty of any crime. They were chosen by Marshal El-Bakar, the Generalissimo of Iraq, either because they were guilty of opposing his regime or because they were Jews. For 3 weeks before these trials, the marshal had gone up and down Baghdad, accusing the pitifully small remnant of Baghdadi Jewry of being a fifth column, of talking of them as a poisonous weed, besmirching the noble Iraqi people. These men were convicted without a chance at justice. Parts of their trial were said on television, and though much was censored, enough came through to make us understand the context, the legitimacy, the justice of these proceedings. The court-appointed defense lawyer spoke only once. This was a sum of what he said. "I apologize to this court for accepting the responsibility of defending these miserable people. I cannot even bring myself to ask for mercy." And he sat down. At one time, one of the Jews in the box cried out something. And the hanging judge turned to him and he said, "You dirty Jew, sit down. Shut up, you Zionist dog." But Babel Hashdodeda, Ashrei Sheyishalem Lach Gemulech Shegamalta Lanu, a daughter of Babylon that art to be destroyed, happy are they who will return unto thee as thou hast served us. I'd like to place these trials, if we can call them that, these lynchings, these hangings, in even another context besides that of righteous indignation. 2 days before these men hung, General Nasser was the host to an international conference which was called the Conference of Solidarity with the Arab Peoples. This was a meeting of riffraff, of well-intentioned Christian missionaries whose hearts bleed for Arab refugees, of leftists from the world over, of all those who have ever hated our people. And they came to Cairo to be told what they can be do in their countries as propaganda merchants for the final liberation of Palestine. But there are a number of sensitive souls among them, men who have to feel that if they're going to join in a holy war, it's because the war is holy and not because they wholly hate the Jewish people. And Mr. Nasser, in his most statesmanlike manner, gave them exactly the language that they were seeking. He asked a series of rhetorical questions, all of which could be answered no and should be answered no, and these are the questions. And I quote, "Has the Arab world ever in history practiced anti-Semitism? Has it ever persecuted Jews? Have the Jews known greater tolerance than that which has always reigned in the Arab world?" Now, the answer to all these questions, in fact, is yes. The first people who Muhammad ever attacked were the Jewish communities near Mecca and Medina, and these were utterly destroyed. Read the Quran, and you will find in there contempt for the Jew, though he gave to Muhammad much of the background of his faith, and the command that these must be kept as subordinate subject people, dhimmis. And in the Middle Ages, the Jews in the Arab world were subject to all of the restrictions that the Jews in the Christian world were subjected to. They had to wear a special yellow sash or a special yellow turban. They could not ride on certain animals. They could only live in certain parts of the city. They could not rebuild their synagogues if they were destroyed. They had to pay special taxes. They had to show special marks of reverence. And there is no Arab city in the world which does not have its chronicle of pogrom and of persecution quite as long and quite as brutal as that of any city in Europe. But Nasser could count on the fact that those who were assembled before him didn't know the intricacies and the byways of Jewish history. And he could count on the fact that none of them would bother to leave the sumptuous hall of the Hilton Hotel where they were meeting and go down to the Mela and look at the squalid quarter in which a few thousand Egyptian Jews remain, or visit the prisons where every adult male Egyptian Jew has been imprisoned since June of 1967. And he could probably count on the fact that even though these headlines of the hangings broke just 2 days after this great hypocritical speech, most of those who were assembled would see no connection between the questions and the assumptions he had raised and the blatant anti-Semitism which was being practiced. For men have an infinite capacity for illusion, and self-delusion. Has the Arab world ever in history practiced anti-Semitism? The answer is yes, and yes, and yes again. Is the Arab world practicing anti-Semitism? The answer is yes, and yes, and yes again. There are 120,000 Jews in Iraq in 1947. Many of these Jews came from the descendants of settlers who had come to Iraq 3,000 years ago. In November of 1947, by a single act, These descendants of Jews, many of whom had come to Iraq 1,200 years before the first Muslim Arab, were declared to be enemy aliens. And they were penned up in Iraq, not allowed to receive aid, not allowed to leave, not allowed to travel within the country. All kinds of restrictions were placed on them. And for 2 years, the Iraqi government proceeded to expropriate the land, their land, to take away their wealth. And finally, in November of 1950, 114,000 were allowed to leave, each one carrying one bundle of household goods. 3,000 years of history, one bundle of blankets, suits, and pillows. 6,000 Jews remained in Iraq. And these were the Iraqis of Jewish persuasion, those who could not bring themselves to go to Israel. And they too were then subjected to an intensive program of anti-Semitic discrimination. Their children were not allowed to enroll in the universities, their telephones were tapped, they were placed under constant surveillance. They were not allowed to receive aid from the outside, they were denied export-import licenses. Physicians and dentists were allowed the privilege of practice. And little by little, this community was whittled down in half. And then in June of 1967, the 3,000 who remained were placed under close house arrest. They were allowed to leave for only 2 to 3 hours a day. They were sealed off from the outside world. Not even a letter could get through. They were not allowed to have schools or meetings or services of any kind. 100 of their heads of families were thrown into jail on the charge that the public required it. And then these trials. Anti-Semitism? Surely. What else is it? These are not the Zionist spies that their propaganda makes them out to be. These are the few who resisted the immemorial claims of Zion on the heart of the Jew. Had they been Zionists, they would have left long since. These were the Iraqis of Jewish persuasion. These are those who have suffered and are suffering today. Has the Arab world ever in history practiced anti-Semitism? Yes, and yes, and yes again. When the UN Commission on Human Rights made inquiries of the Iraqi government, they were not even accorded the privilege of a response. When Jewish agencies, the International Red Cross, and others asked for privilege to meet with, to get in and visit, to bring aid to these people, they were denied that privilege. Parenthetically, if you want to measure the state of the world's conscience, remind yourself of this. In Israel, there's freedom of movement for the press, for any official foreign visitor. There's no part of Israel which cannot be entered, and no one who cannot be interviewed. And yet the United Nations Security Council found it appropriate to create a three-nation commission some months ago in order to investigate charges that the Israelis were mistreating and tormenting the Arabs in the territories that were annexed in 1967. When Israel made the counter-proposition that at the same time, this commission or any other commission visit Syria and Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, seek the welfare of the Jews, the beaten, bruised Jews of these countries, not a single nation on the Security Council was willing even to sponsor such a resolution. Such is the state of selective morality. 1969. Are we not surprised to find General Nasser to be a hypocrite? And I'm afraid we ought not to be surprised to find that there are nations which will hold Jews as hostage, and treat them as animals, and throw their carcasses to the dogs. But I cite this history not only because it tells us something about the life, the world in which we live, and the cold realism with which we must judge our future, but because it says something very important to us about the solution, if there be one, to the tensions in the Middle East. The problem between Israel and her neighbors is not a simple political problem. It therefore is not amenable to a simple political solution. The Arab world is conditioned by 1,300 years of Muslim propaganda to believe itself superior, to believe that it has certain arrogant rights to impose its faith and its way by the sword, to believe that Jew, and if the Christians were weak enough, Christians too, are subject people who can be tolerated as long as they are subservient, but only so. The situation is inflamed by 25 or 30 years of constant propaganda, which has poisoned now two generations in the Arab world, played on these ancient hates, inflamed them, blown them to fever pitch, and convinced generation after generation of the young that there is no compromise and no adjustment and no living together, that the Jew is the enemy, and that until Israel is reduced and destroyed, the holy sword cannot be put down, and the holy war cannot be brought to an end. What I'm saying can be put differently. Even if an Arab government today sincerely wanted to make peace because it had become convinced that it had to get about the urgent business of economic and social reconstruction because it could not continue to bear the weight of the armaments budgets, the drain on its skills, on its manpower, and on its wealth that this constant armament tension was requiring, even if such a government decided honestly to accept some international arrangement imposed upon the Middle East, it could not. Because the mob is inflamed, because there are in each of these countries demagogues prepared to rise to power on the passions of the mob, because any government which made such a rational decision would soon find itself out in the cold with another group of people, more fanatic, in their places. Now, as you know, there have been talk of plenty these last months about a Big Four conference between the Soviet Union and France and Great Britain and the United States, which would somehow thrash out all the political problems of the Middle East in line with certain Security Council decisions, and then by economic and presumably military sanction, impose these upon the Middle East. And it has been Israel's constant position in the last 2 years that no peace will ever be meaningful in the Middle East until it is a face-to-face arrangement between the competing parties. And Israel's logic is precisely this, that until that time comes, when it is to the best interests of these Arab states and of their peoples to make peace, to arrange, to negotiate, any piece of paper which is signed, any words which are pledged are meaningless and worse, because no Arab government can make good on them, and because, in point of fact, they have no intentions of so doing. When General Nasser speaks to the senior editor of Newsweek, he speaks as a statesman. He's willing to negotiate international waterways. He's willing to discuss a UN presence in the Middle East. He's willing to talk about the language in which Egypt might somehow recognize a state of non-belligerency with a non-existing neighbor. But when he talks to his own people, he talks to them quite openly, in language which is published, but which some in the chanceries of the West refuse to read. And he says to them simply this: diplomacy is an instrument of national policy. Our national policy is to destroy Israel. Step one is to force the Israelis to roll back from the new borders which are more defensible, from the land which gives them natural resource, from those empty buffer zones in the Golan and the Sinai which give them territory to fall back through which they never had before. And we have to give up very little, if anything, in return. Words, empty words, promises that someday in some way we will somehow admit that there may be something called Israel someplace on the globe. And there are a thousand ways to cancel these words. But in the meantime, we will have achieved the rollback of Israel's armies. Her borders will be longer and less defensible. She will be in a more untenable position. Our troops will be closer to her major cities, and we can plan for step two in the liquidation process. Ask yourself why it is that the two protagonists of the Arab cause, the Soviet Union and France, are the two protagonists of Big Four negotiations. They're not doing it out of love of peace. If they wanted peace, there's a very simple way. The Soviet Union could tomorrow embargo any further arms to the Middle East. Without her technicians, without her arms, Egypt would have no prayer for a fourth round. But the arms keep streaming in, and France keeps adding her aid and her airplanes. If they wanted peace, the way to peace is clear. Let them stop propagandizing the Arab line throughout the world. Let them stop using the Security Council as an instrument of Arab policy. But that's not the way they go about it. They're far more skillful and far more devious. And what they're talking about is simply this: a first step. Let's talk to the West about defusing the powder keg. Let's tell the United States, here's a way of avoiding an East-West confrontation which neither of us wish. All you have to do is throw Israel to the dogs. It's very simple. It won't cost you anything. All you have to agree is that you will agree to a statement that Israel must begin now to withdraw to the borders of 1967. And as a palliative to your people, to public opinion in the United States, we'll have some words that Amman and Cairo must make some statements about the possibility of Israel's actually being, and the whole thing will be smoothed over. And as you know also, the new administration has evidenced some willingness to discuss the possibility of such big four conversations. Last week, Mr. Nixon announced that there would be a series of bilateral conferences between England, France, the Soviet Union, the United States, at the United Nations, to consider whether or not there was a sufficient solid ground of agreement to warrant more formal conversations. Now, in all probability, Mr. Nixon could have done little else. His test is yet to come. It is not clear yet whether, in point of fact, he is simply gaining time, because he must know that if he retains the traditional policies of the last administration, made clear again by President Johnson just 2 weeks before he went out of office, and that is that the withdrawal by Israel must be coupled with secure and valid and meaningful contracts by the Arab states having to do with sovereignty and the right of existence and non-belligerency, and having to do also with the fact that the 1967 borders are not the established borders in that area, that Israel has the right to certain areas in the Golan, presumably in around Jerusalem and in Sinai, which will give her a more rational national configuration. Mr. Nixon accepts these traditional policies of the American administration, then he must know that there will not be the solid ground for agreement to proceed with more formal talks, This is not what Moscow has in mind at all, and that all he is doing is gaining some time, hoping that there will be pressures within the Arab world of one sort or another, which may make them in time more amenable to direct negotiations with Israel. We must remember that even though we know Israel and recognize its problems, all of the Arab states have their own problems. Mr. Nasser represents defeat. His students are in revolt. His universities are closed. His trade unionists have been on the street. His economy would be absolutely bankrupt were it not for Soviet aid. The standard of living of his people has dropped precipitously over the last 4 years. There are internal tensions which can, in point of fact, bring about changes within each of the Arab states. And Russia is as leery of some of these changes as is the United States. For if a new man comes to power in Cairo, he may not be oriented towards Moscow, he may be far more radical and be oriented towards Peking. On the other hand, Mr. Nixon may be beginning again the Republican policies of 1956 and 1957, which essentially represented the need for, the overriding need for peaceful coexistence between the two major powers, which saw everything else as capable of being sacrificed to this overriding necessity, and which devised a formula which in a sense freed the United States from any sense of moral responsibility for the fate of the Middle East. And the formula was a relatively simple one. We're going to say that this problem should be in the lap of the United Nations, of the Security Council. It's their problem, not ours. The United States is prepared to cooperate in any decision of the Security Council. But the Security Council is a loaded instrument. And so the United States can say, well, we must cooperate with the world body, we must do what they tell us to do, we must go along with whatever the imposed peace which they order is. And in that position, Israel is left without the one major support which he's had these last few years, and she's forced to go it alone. The United States' position has been clear. Presumably it remains so. But the future remains problematic. And what all of us must understand, it seems to me, is simply this. All of this talk of peace is heady wine. Everyone wants peace. No one wants conflict, an escalated confrontation, war, and certainly world war. But our desperate desire for peace should not force us to take precipitate actions which will not bring about the end which we seek. If we want peace, the way is not through big power negotiations and arms embargoes and military sanctions, because the big powers themselves are protagonists. They have interests in the area. They are not judges who are outside the pressures of society. Each of them has economic and political interests of first water in the Middle East. They have their own axes to grind. And the axe grinds, I'm afraid, more on Israel. Whatever they would come up with would ultimately be dismantled. No imposed peace in the history of the world has ever proven lasting and secure. Only way that we have, I'm afraid, is the way of patience and the way of vigilance. To keep Israel strong, to pray for that moment which inevitably comes when nations as individuals mature sufficiently to accept reality, even though it may not be all that they want, to learn to live within a marriage, within a family, within a world community, with world neighbors who are not all that they or we might want them to be. If you will understand the Arab states today, read Mr. Nasser. but read not only what he puts out for Western consumption, for our ears, where he's all peaceful and diplomatic and interested only in the legitimate problems of Egypt. Read the Mr. Nasser who came before the conference of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the terrorists, which met in Cairo just 10 days ago. Read Nasser, who said there this: our aims are the same. Our goals are identical. You say that there cannot be any diplomatic solutions. I agree with you. You say that the only solution is war. I agree with you. Our only difference lies in this: that you want war now, and I want war after my enemy is weakened. And I say to you that it is through diplomacy that in the near term we will weaken Israel. And then he turned around and he gave to these bandits missiles and mortars and their first tanks. Unfortunately, the Arab world has not yet come to the moment when it is prepared to concede the existence of Israel. And until it does, there will be no peace. And until it does, any attempt to impose peace is imposed by the enemies of Israel or by groups which represent majorities of those who are inimical to Israel's interests, can only weaken that state, can only hasten the time when there is a bloody confrontation, as those who have returned have vowed to pay with their lives before they are set again on the road of exile. Once before, our fathers wept by the rivers of Babylon. Once before, they cursed their tormentors and their enemies. But unlike those days, today, Israel's fate depends ultimately on the resolve of the people of Israel to live and on the support which Jews round the world will give to that state. We need not find ourselves again shackled, manacled slave labor in exile. It's going to take courage, sacrifice, and determination. And I'm afraid we're going to be about this business of survival for a long time. Sunshine soldier and summer patriot is going to get very tired before Israel is truly secure. And what I fear, and my only fear really, is that we may lack the steadfastness. We may be so terrified of the possibilities that we may resist the obvious truth. We have no alternative now but to support, to encourage the sitting fast, to sustain, to provide, to encourage, to hope for that day when new men and new policies may truly permit negotiation in the Middle East. Amen.